Random House Audio presents My Life by Bill Clinton. Read for you by the author.
When I was a young man just out of law school and eager to get on with my life, on a whim I briefly put aside my reading preference for fiction and history and bought one of those how-to books, How to Get Control of Your Time and Your Life by Alan Lakin. The book's main point was the necessity of listing short, medium, and long-term life goals, then categorizing them in order of their importance, with the A group being the most important, the B group next, and the C the last, then listing under each goal specific activities designed to achieve them. I still have that paperback book, now almost 30 years old, and I'm sure I have that old list somewhere buried in my papers, though I can't find it. However, I do remember the A list. I wanted to be a good man, have a good marriage and children, have good friends, make a successful political life, and write a great book. Whether I'm a good man is, of course, for God to judge. I know that I'm not as good as my strongest supporters believe, or as I hope to become, nor as bad as my harshest critics assert. I have been graced beyond measure by my family life with Hillary and Chelsea. Like all families' lives, ours is not perfect, but it has been wonderful. Its flaws, as all the world knows, are mostly mine, and its continuing promise is grounded in their love. No person I know ever had more or better friends. Indeed, a strong case can be made that I rose to the presidency on the shoulders of my personal friends, the now legendary FOBs. My life in politics was a joy. I love campaigns and I love governing. I always tried to keep things moving in the right direction, to give more people a chance to live their dreams, to lift people's spirits, and to bring them together. That's the way I kept score. As for the great book, who knows? It sure is a good story. Early on the morning of August 19, 1946, I was born under a clear sky after a violent summer storm to a widowed mother in the Julia Chester Hospital in Hope, a town of about 6,000 in southwest Arkansas, 33 miles east of the Texas border at Texarkana. My mother named me William Jefferson Blythe III, after my father, William Jefferson Blythe, Jr., one of nine children of a poor farmer in Sherman, Texas, who died when my father was 17. According to his sisters, my father always tried to take care of them and grew up to be a handsome, hard-working, fun-loving man. He met my mother at Tri-State Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, in 1943, when she was training to be a nurse. Many times when I was growing up, I asked Mother to tell me the story of their meeting, courting, and marriage. He brought a date with some kind of medical emergency into the ward where she was working, and they talked and flirted while the other woman was being treated. On his way out of the hospital, he touched the finger on which she was wearing her boyfriend's ring and asked her if she was married. She stammered, no, she was single. The next day, he sent the other woman flowers, and her heart sank. Then he called Mother for a date, explaining that he always sent flowers when he ended a relationship. 2 months later, they were married, and he was off to war. He served in a motor pool in the invasion of Italy, repairing jeeps and tanks. After the war, he returned to Hope for Mother, and they moved to Chicago, where he got back his old job as a salesman for the Manby Equipment Company. They bought a little house in the suburb of Forest Park, but couldn't move in for a couple of months. And since Mother was pregnant with me, they decided she should go home to Hope until they could get into the new house. On May 17, 1946, after moving their furniture into their new home, my father was driving from Chicago to Hope to fetch his wife. Late at night on Highway 60 outside of Sikeston, Missouri, he lost control of his car, a 1942 Buick, when the right front tire blew out on a wet road. He was thrown clear of the car but landed in, or crawled into, a drainage ditch dug to reclaim swampland. The ditch held 3 feet of water. When he was found after a two-hour search, his hand was grasping a branch above the waterline. He had tried, but failed, to pull himself out. He drowned, only 28 years old, married 2 years and 8 months, only 7 months of which he had spent with Mother. This brief sketch is about all I ever really knew about my father. All my life I've been hungry to fill in the blanks, clinging eagerly to every photo or story or scrap of paper that would tell me more of the man who gave me life. I was born on my grandfather's birthday, a couple of weeks early, weighing in at a respectable 6 pounds, 8 ounces, on a 21-inch frame. Mother and I came home to her parents' house on Hervey Street in Hope, where I would spend the next 4 years. That old house seemed massive and mysterious to me then, and still holds deep memories today. The people of Hope raised the funds to restore it and fill it with old pictures, memorabilia, and period furniture. They call it the Clinton Birthplace. It certainly is a place I associate with awakening to life, to the smells of country food, to buttermilk churns, ice cream makers, washboards, and clotheslines, to my Dick and Jane readers, my first toys, including a simple length of chain I prized above them all, to strange voices talking over our party-line telephone, to my first friends, and the work my grandparents did. After a year or so, my mother decided she needed to go back to New Orleans to Charity Hospital, where she had done part of her nursing training, to learn to be a nurse anesthetist. In the old days, doctors had administered their own anesthetics, so there was a demand for this relatively new work, which would bring more prestige to her and more money for us. But it must have been hard on her leaving me. On the other hand, New Orleans was an amazing place after the war, full of young people, Dixieland music, and over-the-top haunts like the club My Oh My, where men in drag danced and sang as lovely ladies. I guess it wasn't a bad place for a beautiful young widow to move beyond her loss. While Mother was in New Orleans, I was in the care of my grandparents. They were incredibly conscientious about me. They loved me very much, sadly much better than they were able to love each other, or in my grandmother's case, to love my mother. Of course, I was blissfully unaware of all this at the time. I just knew that I was loved. Later, when I became interested in children growing up in hard circumstances and learned something of child development from Hillary's work at the Yale Child Study Center, I came to realize how fortunate I had been. For all their own demons, my grandparents and my mother always made me feel I was the most important person in the world to them. Most children will make it if they have just one person who makes them feel that way. I had three. My grandmother, Edith Grisham Cassidy, stood just over 5 feet tall and weighed about 180 pounds. Mamma was bright, intense, and aggressive, and had obviously been pretty once. She had a great laugh, but she was also full of anger and disappointment, an obsession she only dimly understood. She took it all out in raging tirades against my grandfather and my mother, both before and after I was born, though I was shielded from most of them. She had been a good student and ambitious, so after high school she took a correspondence course in nursing from the Chicago School of Nursing. By the time I was a toddler, she was a private duty nurse for a man not far from our house on Hervey Street. I can still remember running down the sidewalk to meet her when she came home from work. I adored my grandfather, the first male influence in my life, and always felt pride that I was born on his birthday. James Eldridge Cassidy was a slight man, about 5'8", but in those years still strong and handsome. I always thought he resembled the actor Randolph Scott. My grandfather was an incredibly kind and generous man. During the Depression, when nobody had any money, he would invite boys to ride the ice truck with him just to get them off the street. They earned 25 cents a day. When I was living with him, my grandfather had two jobs that I really loved. He ran a little grocery store, and he supplemented his income by working as a night watchman at a sawmill. I loved spending the night with Papaw at the sawmill. We would take a paper bag with sandwiches for supper, and I would sleep in the back seat of the car. And on clear, starlit nights, I would climb in the sawdust piles, taking in the magical smells of fresh-cut timber and sawdust. My grandfather loved working there, too. It got him out of the house, and reminded him of the mill work he'd done as a young man around the time of my mother's birth. Except for the time Papaw closed the car door on my fingers in the dark, those nights were perfect adventures. The grocery store was a different sort of adventure. First, there was a huge jar of Jackson's cookies on the counter, which I raided with gusto. Second, grown-ups I didn't know came in to buy groceries, for the first time exposing me to adults who weren't relatives. Third, a lot of my grandfather's customers were black. Though the South was completely segregated back then, some level of racial interaction was inevitable in small towns, just as it had always been in the rural South. However, it was rare to find an uneducated rural Southerner without a racist bone in his body. That's exactly what my grandfather was. I could see that black people looked different, but because he treated them like everybody else, asking after their children and about their work, I thought they were just like me.